They have been gnawed upon.
It is said they eat the dead.
What kind of a man could do that?
It was not man. It's a Mendo.
They are here.
Welcome to Exposition Street, celebrating geek movies in all their splendiferous glory. Thank you very much for joining us today. This is episode number 19 of our brand new, well, not as brand new, but still pretty new, film cast from the folks at Prismatic Tsunami. My name is Eric. I'll be your host today. And we got a great show lined up for you. I hope you've seen the movie. We'll talk about it here in just a minute, let you know what it is we're going to be discussing today. First, I want to go ahead and introduce the panel. Brought in for his flown in, especially for his technical expertise. We got Rich with us today. How you doing?
I'm actually made it. That's nice.
All right. Straight from film school, a la somewhere in New Zealand, I think. We got Vanessa.
Sure. Why not?
Jason showed up, so we let him in the door.
He's coming from the mist.
Oh, and that's the kid.
Spent $50 on that fog machine.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very nicely done, sir. I can't breathe and I can't see, but I appreciate the special effects. Practical effects. It's all practical effects budget.
Yeah, none of this is CGI.
None of this was inserted later.
No CGI.
If you're not watching us on Twitch, you don't know what we're talking about. It's all great. But this ought to be an interesting one. God, this movie was a little on the darker side compared to some of the... And we've done some dark movies, but we've done dark gothic-y or dark gritty in another way. This was a little different, I think.
Post-apocalyptic as opposed to pre-apocalyptic.
Right. How do you like that? We're going to talk about The 13th Warrior. Released August 27th, 1999, and went straight to number 2 at the box office.
We may mention the other 12 as well.
We may not. Number 2 at the box office. Only made $10.2 million its opening weekend, but it was number 1 behind The Sixth Sense, which was on its 27th week. No, it's on its 4th week. And Sixth Sense still made $20 million. Still doubled this one, its opening weekend. Rated R. Runtime of 1 hour and 42 minutes. The synopsis basically is, I need like theme music, don't I? Except some of these are terrible. Actually, that would make it better, wouldn't it? A man having fallen in love with the wrong woman, I don't know why they bothered to put it in here, is sent by the Sultan himself on a diplomatic mission to a distant land as an ambassador. Stopping at a Viking village port to restock on supplies, he finds himself unwittingly embroiled in a quest to banish a mysterious threat in a distant Viking land. Directed by Mr. John McTiernan, famous for Die Hard, my favorite Christmas movie. Also did like Hunt for Red October, Last Action Hero. The same year they did this, the Thomas Crown Affair came out, but that's probably not as notable as the others. I like me some McTiernan. I think he was great. This was actually, unfortunately, kind of the stumbling point in his career, because this movie kind of bombed. Only kind of bombed.
Like that makes a lot. Me sad.
Oh, gosh.
Kinda?
Oh, gosh. It was awful.
Kinda? Even in cult status, it is still really... There's a crater, sir.
I guess I get that.
It deserves so much better than that.
It does. It really does, but we are shoveling grains of sand into a pit, trying to fill the hole that this bomb left.
And when I say...
Not my first rodeo.
His next three movies, I mean, were, like, derailed. The Thomas Crown Affair, Rollerball, Basic... I mean, he was just on a downhill climb at that point in terms of the returns.
Well,
so
Thomas Crown Affair was pretty good.
Thomas Crown was good.
Rollerball?
I enjoyed it a lot.
Really?
But yeah.
Josh Hartnett.
Well, I will tell you, if they had called this movie The Eaters of the Dead, I would have watched it the week it came out like I did The Sixth Sense.
There's a lot about that, actually. We'll have a chance to talk about that. Because originally it was. Originally,
and apparently it was unwatchable.
Yeah, apparently it didn't do so well. Test audiences didn't like it. And, well, okay, quick poll. Who did everybody like this film? Is this one a good one for us?
I freaking love it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
It's on the right side of three.
On the right side of three? I'm not sure what that is for you, sir.
That's a positive review.
That's a positive review. All right. Well, I know you particularly had seen the movie numerous times.
I have, and I had never previously watched it with a critical eye. Damn you, Eric Carle.
Written by Mr. Michael Crichton, or at least he wrote the novel, and had a lot to do with the movie, interestingly enough. I don't know if you guys got into any of the trivia on this, but it's pretty salacious.
IMDb says he wasn't even credited on the movie.
Nope, he sure wasn't, except as the writer of the novel. And William Wisher did the screenplay, which was, he did like Terminator 1, 2, he did like Judge Dredd.
Oh, director uncredited.
A lot of stuff.
I'm sorry, I'm not reading. Words are hard.
What happened apparently is McTiernan directed his version of the movie, which was rife with, according to the actors, rife with show don't tell moments, extended a lot of scenes, more than what we saw, ended with a final runtime of well over 2 hours. And the studio panicked, trimmed almost all of it out, making numerous scenes much more literal or replaced with brief expositions. Entire sequences were fully removed. There were some minor plot holes afterwards. The execs got involved and decided to shoot a couple of endings, one by McTiernan. The other one, Michael Crichton came in to kind of save the movie after test audiences didn't like the first cut. And he ended up, doing a lot of directing, like almost like a second unit. But it was like he was reshooting and stuff, doing a lot of reshoots and stuff. So the budget was getting pretty bloated at that point. After about 3 years of work, infights, countless changes, gutting the last act of the movie, the studio decided just to drop it into the studio. It's into the cinemas, no premiere, marketing, just get rid of it before it would cost another million or two to maintain the production. So basically, this film never had a chance.
Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of the heart of it. I mean, I don't know whether or not the quality of the movie would have stood up with proper promotion and would have done really well in the theater or not. Here's the funny thing about this film. I'd watched this before, obviously. I'd seen this once or twice. And I couldn't remember. I remember the story. I remember the basic idea. I remember Antonio Banderas. I remember the characters. And we'll get into that. But I couldn't have told you what it was I loved about the movie, because all I could really remember was that it was good. But it seemed in my memory that everything had this kind of dark cast to it, and it was very gray and no levity that I remembered, except for a couple of lines, which turned out to be true. But I had so much more fun watching this movie than I remembered. And I'm sure that's what that led to, that feeling that it was a great movie. It was a good movie. So I don't know. I mean, it might have held up. Yeah, an additional interesting bit there. Originally, the score was done by Graham Revell, and Crichton trashed it and brought in Jerry Goldsmith to record a new score. Of course, I love Goldsmith even more than I do Revell, so it's fine. I have no issue with that. The music in the movie is really good.
It really is.
And I mean, judging by the number of Goldsmith's scores that I had on my physical musical rack before everything was digital, I'd say I like his work. No, big chance.
Was this on there?
I don't think so. He did a ton of Star Trek stuff, though. Mm. So, and I've always loved a lot of that. And he did The Mummy, and he did the music for Mulan, not the new one. Well, I don't know. Maybe the new one. I have no idea. Congo. So this wasn't his first Crichton film either. And
not that Congo.
And there's something to be said for the whole, because the whole Michael Crichton experience in this is kind of hands-on. And we don't know what he was really personally responsible for, wasn't. I found it interesting that some reports say that a lot of the changes that he made actually were bigger departures from the book that he wrote.
That's hilarious.
Than were the original script. Just kind of a sense of making things work differently, I guess.
Well, but it's a different medium, and he obviously gets that.
But I mean, Michael Crichton, I mean, he wrote Jurassic Park.
Oh, we know.
Congo, Sphere. I mean, he's been Rising Sun. I mean, there's been a number of movies that in this time period that just catapulted his name into stardom out there. And he was already a very successful author before any of this, mm-hmm. and had been having his movies optioned for time out of mind. And I've hardly ever read any of his work, but people
I've
really
read
like it.
Many of them. And
I read Jurassic Park.
Very much enjoyed all of his novels. Mm-hmm. He is a very skilled author.
I've read all but one.
Oh, yeah.
Which one haven't you read?
Read Rising.
Rising Sun?
Rising Sun.
Ah, I haven't read that one either.
The one,
damn it.
It takes place in San Francisco or LA or something, but it's
when
one
I had
Japanese
the book, I couldn't get into
culture.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Which was a great movie. Sean Connery, Wesley Snipes.
I watched
Snipes.
The movie.
It was fantastic. I loved it. Let's see. The movie was originally could be called Eaters of the Dead, part of the not test screening well, I guess. Yeah, in 98, they were going to release it under that title and didn't happen to hold on to it. So let's see. Starring Mr. Antonio Banderas as Ahmed Ibn Fadien, Ibn whatever, Ibn something else, Ibn another name.
Eben.
Now, despite the whole casting Antonio is an Arab, which I guess wasn't as extreme a choice because there's a lot of common features in that ancestry.
It feels weird, but I think he did it well.
He was really good at it.
It was just the Spanish accent was really strange, and it struck me more now than it did then.
At the time, yeah.
Didn't bother me in the least.
Once upon a time, it didn't bother me at all. And now I'm just kind of like, there's a lot of really good Arabic actors. They could have done
exactly
better than that.
Oh, yeah.
And it's strangely that, I mean, this was obviously, there's been talk about that, you know, the whitewashing in Hollywood for years, but there's been so much more talk about it in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Of course, Antonio Banderas isn't exactly whitewashing anything.
But I was going to say, what do you call that? He's more of a bronze color.
On the other hand,
very pretty bronze color.
They had enough trouble getting butts in the seats as it was.
And
if it didn't have Antonio Banderas,
he's got a name.
Right. There are great Arabic actors out there, but none of them have the draw of Antonio Banderas.
Or did at the time, anyway, yeah. This was, I mean, really kind of a high point in his career, too. He had just done Mask of Zorro the year before this. It had just come out, which was the first of the two Zorro movies.
Oh,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I love
Spy Kids was in a one, you know, which was, of course, a huge hit as well.
He was
really
in Spy Kids?
He was the dad. Are you kidding?
Oh, snap. He was, wasn't he?
Did you just say, oh, snap?
Yeah.
Oh, dear God. Somebody
Mario coin.
Help me
Mario
out.
Coin.
Mario coin. That's funny.
Wither.
Damn you, Vanessa.
No, you should totally Mario coin that both times, and then people will think that she said something censored.
Instead of snap. Yeah.
And Mario coin that one, too.
A lot of coins there. We're going to need to quit using that word.
I'm with it. I'm on it. I'm hip to this jive. No worries.
Of course, if there was ever a time we didn't have to do all the Mario coins, it would be this episode because it is an R-rated film.
I didn't know until I looked into it that Amin ibn Fadlan was an actual, like, historical person.
That's a discussion point I was looking forward to getting into, actually.
I didn't read much. It said in the trivia that he traveled as an emissary to the land of the Volga Burghars to convert them to Islam. On his way, he encountered Turks in Central Asia and Russia. The Varangians returned in 923, and there's, like, no record after that, after this date, that refers to it all. So, I mean, not a lot to go on there, but I'm guessing there's a lot more information out there. I mean, his writings, obviously.
Yes, there was an archaeological find that included a journal that was written by him. And that journal was the seed of the story that Michael Crichton wrote. So it was very loosely, in a roundabout way, based on historical object.
Makes sense.
Now, see,
Eaters of the Dead has a lot of footnotes specifically referencing back to what was in the documents, mm-hmm. The manuscripts.
I have found, and it's not the most reliable sourcing and whatnot, but I have seen things that said that all of those things that Michael Crichton footnoted and referenced as historical documents were his own composure, and it was 100% fraudulent, and the university at which place this book is said to have been held tells people that they are victims of fraud every time they go to check it out or look at it, and that the name of the translator is Fraus Dolos, which is fraud in Latin.
That's awesome.
Wow.
You
dived deeper than I did,
sir. Oh my.
Apparently we're all victims of fraud.
Although that is the type of story you would expect to hear from someone trying to simply discredit somebody else. So who knows where the actual truth is.
The thing that but it follows up with the fact that it was Michael Crichton answering a dare to make Beowulf interesting.
This is a very Beowulf story.
Oh, it is. It is.
There's kind of the heart of it, yeah. And in my memories, it always is. Like, we're watching the 13th World. Oh, that's that Beowulf flick. Even though it's got, in the details, nothing.
A passing to resemblance
do.
Yeah. At most, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's got Beowulf, though. I mean,
it's
Bullseye instead of Beowulf.
Directly to Beowulf, it's kind
of instead of Wendell, or Wendell instead of Grendel.
But it's all about Grendel's mother.
Yeah, that's true. Diane Venora was Queen Willow. I couldn't find a lot on her. I mean, I've definitely seen her in some movies, I guess. She was in Romeo and Juliet in 96, The Jackal in 97. Those were both before this. The Jackal was that one I was talking about last week where Bruce Willis played a bad guy. Played an assassin.
I actually watched that last week.
Not one of his best roles, but it was a pretty intense movie.
Yeah, it had some really good, some really fun stuff in it.
I don't remember her at all. And she could have played the lead for all I know. I mean, I don't remember her at all.
No, I pretty much Bruce Willis is the only memorable character. And the scene where he is testing out the gun on the dude that sold him the gun is hilarious.
And a couple of the Vikings, Dennis Storhall was our, you know, Herger. Was that how you say it? Mm-hmm. Herger, was it the Joyous? Is that the guy?
Wait, what?
Yeah, I had such a hard time keeping track of Viking names.
Yeah, the names were tough.
Which is why in the credit they were listed by their dominant personality type instead of by their name.
He was awesome. He was so good and so much fun. And so, had such a great smile that I thought he really brought the movie together. If it was,
was he the main brother. One that was kept calling him little brother? Yeah.
Figure you were seeing the movie. It's got this very kind of almost, I mean, not quite first person limited. It is in the terms of narration, but it's a very limited perspective. We follow him through, Ahmed, we follow him to almost everything. You know, so when scenes are going on, action sequences and everything, most of what we're seeing is right around him. When he's with the group trying to do a thing, we follow him. The camera stays with him so much that I felt that was interesting because it really does paint a very specific picture of what's happening.
It's the Stranger in a Strange Land story. It's the story of him being an Arab in a strange land and exploring that land.
So having a character like Herger the Joyous, I don't know if I'm saying the name right, but having a character like that who brings so much to bounce off of and reflect back just made the narrative work, in my opinion.
It worked so well. I enjoyed it.
And he was good. He's a Norwegian actor, so I couldn't find hardly anything else in the English-speaking world that he'd done, but he's really good in this. Vladimir Kulik played Bullywolf, the heir apparent. How did you say it?
Bullvi,
thank you. Which is, of course, the permutation of Beowulf, but most of his credits have been TV as well, but he's still acting as well. The only other person I had notable on here, unless you guys have anybody else to discuss, is Omar Sharif. And his role was brief, though important. And again, really, really hammered on that first person kind of thing, because they kept having these shots where it's like you were looking at him translating from Antonio Banderas's perspective. Like he'd turn and he'd look at the camera. And that was really weird, you know? And I remembered that actually, but he's kind of a legend. He's been acting since the 50s. He died.
That was the uncle that was with him, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was an uncle. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a friend of his
father.
I thought it was uncle.
It was friend of his father.
I can't even pronounce it. The name they had in the, thank you. Well, I'm glad you did say you've seen the movie a few times. Omar died in 2015. Reputedly, he had such a bad experience on the set of this film, was so disappointed by the final cut that he briefly retired from acting afterwards. So, which is surprising since he had such a small role in it. Just at the beginning.
I wonder if originally he had a larger stake in it and part of saving the movie left him on the floor.
Interesting thought.
Just the theory.
I could see that.
I don't know. I don't know how much more he could have done, though.
That's copyright.
Of course, who knows? Yeah. So that's all I got on the actors. Box office, $160 million estimated budget. Although there's, again, some arguments about that because, they did all the reshooting and all the, everything that happened and drug things out. Opening weekend only made $10.2 million, grossed $32 million in the U.S., $61 million cumulative worldwide, was a bomb at the box office. Not in a good way. So
that's unfortunate.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen, the 13th Warrior. What do you got?
I didn't know any of that, but it's absolutely fascinating.
I think it is.
So much going on before this movie ever even got to where I heard of it, much less saw it.
I hadn't heard of it before this podcast, so I can't say much at all.
I'd forgotten about it, and I forgot about it entirely because of the name. Because the 13th Warrior means nothing to me.
Because you're a Crichton
Eaters
fan.
Eaters of the Dead takes me right back to... I'm a Crichton fan. Unapologetically.
No, that makes sense. I get that.
Now, talking about point of view, it threw me off at first. And then when it came together, I really liked it. But the language thing, when they chose to do the we'll do it in English so we understand what we're saying, and when we didn't, the whole thing of the character whose entire focus we were on was the one that was translated in so we understood that language.
Right.
So if he understood it, we understood it. And if he didn't, then it was done
very
in a
clever.
Foreign language.
Very clever.
And I ended up really loving that mechanic.
And they played it right.
Awesome.
They didn't rush it. I mean, it felt like it felt like time was passing, and he had all this focus on it, and you could see him concentrating and all this attention.
He said something to.
Interestingly enough,
father's friend said it in Greeks, and he translated it to them.
Not the same mechanic, but in a similar way, I could think of one other movie where they did a thing that seemed reminiscent of this. In The Hunt for Red October, they're speaking Russian, and then there's one point at which. It's Sam Neill and Sean Connery having a conversation in Russian, and they focus the camera zooms in on Sam talking, and suddenly he switches from Russian to English and it zooms back out, and from that point forward they're talking English until late in the movie when they are in the room with some English with some Americans in the same room.
Completely forgotten about that,
right? And it for some reason it immediately took me back to that, and then to find out that John McTiernan directed both films, I thought that was
uh-huh. There you go.
His gimmick.
There you go. But in Hunt for Red October, that really threw me off. I got why they did it, but it threw me off.
But in this, it was done
Never
right.
seen it.
Yeah, they really did it right.
Beautiful.
That's one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever, is
the translating.
Him watching them at the fire and listening to their words and, you know, paying attention. And then all of a sudden, there's one English word. And then there's
and then
two English words. And then a short sentence.
Yeah.
And then a phrase, and then conversation, and then somebody insults his mama.
Because he was a poet and a scholar, and he was not unlearned.
When he started talking, he talked
slowly. He
and very, and like he was working the words out. Right.
Word carefully.
So good.
Although I have to admit, there was one thing that I hadn't caught before, and I feel unlearned and ashamed for not catching this before. The religious context to his chosen insult.
Right.
When he calls the Viking a pig-eating son of a whore.
Nice.
Oh. Wow. I missed
that. I'm like, oh, pig-eating. He's a savage pig-eating. Because Muslims don't eat pigs, and that's an... Right. Oh, got it. It wasn't the son of a whore that was meant as a thing as much as the pig eating was.
That entire sequence, I loved the cinematography and even the music that was behind it, because you could tell that the score for that particular scene was built for you to focus. And you like zone in on that scene because of the way that it's done.
It was introspective.
And I loved it. Really good. Yeah. Yes.
Now,
so
here's the often, in my opinion, overlooked part of that scene that doesn't get discussed much on message boards or anything. Immediately following, so everybody flips out. Where did you learn our language? Even the people that kind of liked him, you know, Happy Viking and everything. It's like, where did you learn our language? I listened. Ah ha ha. In the meantime, Bullseye is sitting in the background on the other side of the fire, don't face. Didn't move.
He was good at that.
Blink, and he was just
But when Ahmed said, I listened, it flashes to him for just a moment, and he nods, just like once.
There's that. Almost imperceptible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then almost immediately following that, Bullseye takes Eben by surprise and says...
With the writing.
You draw sound.
I hear you know how to draw sound. Yeah.
Which, I'm sorry, we just need to abandon the term writing altogether.
Call it drawing sound.
Drawing sound.
I am a sound drawer for a living.
So cool. I am a drawer of sound. That's epic. And this underscores, in my opinion, Bullseye's understated genius, literal brain genius, is he watches him do that once in the dirt at midnight by a fire with horrible shadows and very crummy dirt.
And then when they get off the boat.
A considerable amount of time later. They have traveled, they have oceaned, there have been all these things. He goes, hey.
Speak what I draw. Yeah.
He made one mistake. That man was something. Bullseye was more than just a brute.
And all those character establishing things they did mattered. Yeah, he was a character you really, because that was most of the expression of the character was in those moments, because he was so stoic and so powerful about it. That it was easy to admire the things you were supposed to admire about him, but they wanted you to get a feel for him as a person as well underneath all that, and that he had a real working brain that was constantly, you know, dealing with the problems and working out. When he whispered to the king when they got there, you know, stuff like that. Or when the king said he was going to follow them, and he came up with a really quick reason why he wouldn't.
You need to stay with the children if we fail.
Right.
I have to get this point in here because I am a avid student of Norse culture. I am absolutely fascinated with it. And this movie did such an amazing job of representing that as best as we can tell historically accurately, because we're missing so much information. But from what they have, this was spot on all the way around. And that was one of the points that really earned my respect, because to be a leader amongst the Vikings, it didn't just go to the strongest warrior, which is kind of what people think. You had to be hitting on all cylinders to earn the respect and lead these people. You had to be a warrior, you had to be a scholar, you had to be a poet. And they represent that in that way. It was very amazing to me that it was so well portrayed. I absolutely loved it.
Well, Crichton's a researcher.
Yes, and it shows.
I've read interviews with him where he talks about when he prepares for a book, the reason he releases them so sporadically, when he prepares for a book, he will spend sometimes a year or two immersed in whatever topic or subject it is he's getting involved in. Before he did Rising Sun, he went and lived in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he studied all the gene splicing, all the genetic engineering stuff that they were talking about for Jurassic Park, all the science that he could get his hand on to make it viable, you know, feasible, rather. I feel like there's a lot to say for how well he does at portraying those elements of his research and pulling them in. And it's too bad the movies sometimes pay that short shrift. But
in this movie, it came through so beautifully. Yeah. And it is absolutely 90% of why I have the reaction to this movie that I do.
I will tell you, in the years since I last saw it, which was when it was new, and I don't know what headspace I was in, but there are a lot more things I caught and appreciated this time around that I didn't catch last time, especially with the cultures, because I know a lot more about the cultures, even though I had read the book that was specifically written with extra exposition in it about both cultures. And then there were three. I mean, there was more in this movie,
right?
And you were picking up that third culture, and I got more about that too.
Even though some of it was kind of like at the edges a little bit, the fringes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree. I understand
it. It was consistent and well done.
The title that they chose, the 13th Warrior, is a reference to the jump to the call kind of trope towards the beginning of the movie, where you have an adventure offered and you have this excited response where the heroes, you know, jump up and say, I will be one of these. And, you know, you go all the way around the room until you get to the one that's left, and she has like the little white bones figurines for everybody, and then she pulls up the dark bronzy one to point it to illustrate that the last warrior, the 13th warrior going on this mission,
must be no Northman.
I have to admit, because I've been thinking about that, you know, since the book was called Eaters of the Dead, which is a very powerful reference to the Wendel, I kept wondering if I could have come up with a better title, and I think the 13th warrior actually is pretty good since it's him.
Yeah,
since it's him.
His story.
But
I almost wish the book had been titled 13th Warrior. I would have been better off all the way straight through.
Really? Yeah, I can see that.
But
Eaters of the Dead kind of gives something away in a way.
Well, not necessarily, because it doesn't say that they're not demon.
Right, right, right.
You know, it does take a little bit of the punch from they've been gnawed upon.
Gosh,
that's a fun reveal that if you're the first time you're watching it, that you wouldn't have got if it was called the Eaters of the Dead, because as soon as you found dead people, you would have expected them to be gnawed upon instead of being prized. But I dig the 13th Warrior title, because if it was called the Eaters of the Dead, I never would have watched it in the first place.
It puts you squarely in the fact that Banderas' character is the focus point of the story and where the point of view is coming from.
It really does. It really shines the spotlight on the point.
The other thing is, I noticed there's a lot of very they did a lot to bring, however it came together, the script did a lot to bring a lot of different feels and factors all into play in the same movie. Not gratuitously in most cases, and it lacked some of the stuff we're used to seeing. It wasn't like heavy romance or anything like that, I mean, which we see in like every freaking movie under the sun.
Not heavy.
I was fine with that.
Vanessa was fine with that. there was stuff like the brotherhood, you know, that was there was so much subtext too, but was so important. There was that sort of that subversion of expectations, like the scene when I'm going to butcher his name every time, Herger, who when he does the fight, the duel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, which his explanation of at the end was very clever and very kind of, you had to stop and think. Okay. That yeah. Made me I mean, smile. I get it. It was so good. And then a lot of the noble stuff there, I mean, this hit some feels for me that were really strong. And I mean, they kept coming at me unexpectedly. Like the movie isn't telegraphing this. It isn't really preparing for this. And suddenly it's like, you know, good in good ways.
It's an awesome display of the kind of power you can get by not relying heavily upon foreshadowing, which has become such a constant that it kind of throws people when you don't see it.
Yeah, exactly. Not saying it wasn't there, though.
Not relying on foreshadowing?
No, for those specific moments, obviously there was some incredible foreshadowing.
I would say this movie was shocked.
Yes.
Full.
And I'm not saying it wasn't. I was pointing out that by choosing to omit it for specific things, they created some very powerful scenes,
okay,
which is
okay.
Not something you see done a lot.
That's fair. I was like, for specific scenes, not the movie as a whole.
Right.
Because the movie, that was actually going to be one of my things, is there were so many beautiful callbacks that would have been beautiful moments if they weren't callbacks.
Right, if they weren't set up beforehand.
Like the Viking's prayer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God,
that was great. I love the Viking's prayer.
And all the foreshadowing was done really well as foreshadowing rather than just telegraphing what's going to happen later in the movie.
Yes, and that distinction is so huge. You have to see it done well to really appreciate it, but that distinction is so huge.
And again, we don't know how much of this was changed with the change in direction mm-hmm. in making the movie, but McTiernan is very much a show-don't-tell director. He loves creating stories where you have to read between the lines to see what's going on, or where he doesn't come out and just hit you over the head with what's happening. You know, you figure things out as the main character does, or you know, sometimes you have information they don't, and you are able to put things together in a way that isn't necessarily obvious in the story. You know, and again, I love seeing that stuff. That's a tribute, obviously, to script writing too. But a director has a lot to do with how it plays, how the script plays when you're putting the movie together. Obviously, so I feel strongly that he demonstrates a good sense of that in a lot of his films. So this was no exception, in my opinion. You want to do some clips? We have plenty more to talk about, I'm sure, but we can talk about it as we clip.
Yep.
As we are wont to do. Here's the introduction.
I am Ahmed ibn Fahland, ibn al-Abbas, ibn Rashid, ibn Hamad. And things were not always thus.
That why?
At one time, I was a poet in the greatest city in the world. Life was easy, and I lived without care. Until one fateful day, I met a beautiful woman who belonged to another man.
Jason.
The end of the movie, when the credits rolled, it said cast in order of appearance and then listed Antonio Banderas and all of the other warriors. And I'm like, we didn't meet them until long after we met Omar. We saw Omar Sharif and the Caliph and all of those people long before we saw the warriors. We didn't. He was on the boat. It was not always so. The camera panned out. They were all on the deck.
That's pretty good. I wouldn't have thought of that either.
they were on the deck, and the camera, for 2 seconds, it was not always so.
The film actually started and ended on the boat then. That's kind of cool.
It did.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
And that was actually another callback is he talks about how his life was not always so. And then when he get to the Northmen, such when they've got problems, one of them looks at him and goes, "It was not always so." I'm just like, "Oh, I've heard that before."
Awesome. The Tatars.
I was banished from my home and from all that I knew. So I journeyed by camelback many months into the lands of barbarian peoples, accompanied by Melchizedek, an old friend of my father. Through the lands of the Oghuz, the Hazars, and the Bulgars, into the lands of murderous bandits called Tartars, who attack caravans, slaughtering everyone.
Just kind of a little bit of setup. The travel montage was pretty good. I love camels. I just had to throw that out there. It means nothing. I think they're cool. I also like desert stories.
I don't know that I would necessarily want to ride one, but they do look cool. Yeah, oh, no,
they most definitely look cool from a distance. I'm all on board.
They
there.
Have velvety soft lips.
Yes, but they smell like camels.
Too much information, sir.
Too much love.
They smell like camels.
Camels do indeed smell like camels.
When they grab the carrot out of your hand.
Oh, yeah, like giraffe tongues.
I've never fed a giraffe either, so sure, if you say so.
Might be a little off the topic.
I haven't done.
A little bit.
Crash in the party.
Tabernacolo. He says their king is out there in that tent.
No loquitur.
He says the king will not speak to us.
No loquitur. Qui mortuus est.
Apparently the king won't speak to us because he's dead. This is his funeral.
So I loved the decision that they made here to go ahead and highlight that a Viking funeral is a celebratory event, which is nice.
Under some circumstances.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah.
There is not a celebration if a person, especially a warrior, dies dishonorably, because then they are doomed to hell and there's nothing to celebrate.
Ah.
Yeah, it's if they're expected to go to Valhalla, there's a celebration.
Nice.
Because a Viking's entire life was about dying and going to Valhalla. So they've goal achieved.
I didn't remember the human sacrifice.
Yeah, me
that
either.
That is very old school. By the time Christianity started to influence the Viking culture, that just didn't happen anymore. That's why they said it's the old ways. Because this was right about that point in time.
But you'll never see this again.
This is the last time you'll see it, yeah.
Uh-huh. But up until then, that was actually very common. Because they believed that if they did not, if the wife or in some cases even the children and servants did not sacrifice themselves to go with the patriarch, then they would not be together in the afterlife.
Crazy talk.
Yeah, it was just, that threw me off guard, because as many times as I'd seen it, I didn't remember them putting that girl on the boat.
They didn't put her on there. That was hers. That was her choice.
Well, they put her on. I understand that she was willing, but they were lifting her up and they put her on the boat. And she was saying that.
Okay,
speech.
You meant literally.
Literally, yeah, putting her on the boat. And then.
Fair enough.
She will ride with him.
But it was a great honor for her. So that's why they made a big.
Yeah, again, I wasn't trying to say that she was terrified or scared or, you know, like unwitting in any way. But,
being forced into it? No.
But
yeah, she wasn't being murdered. She was sacrificed.
Exactly. It was a sacrifice, not a murder.
The Viking funeral imagery is pretty strongly entrenched, and that was obviously a nice, almost kind of like, it makes you feel like you're with the story at that point, because we're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, isn't it usually we put him out on the water and fire a flaming arrowhead or something? I don't know. But it worked really nicely.
Yeah.
It was still pretty.
Yep, very much so. Boy's in plain sight.
The boy is letting them see him.
He's in plain sight.
They do not know if what they see is real. Something to do with the mist. Apparently, they find dangerous things, spirits in the mist. The boy was being polite, giving them time to decide if he's real.
I love the superstition and mythology that's being undercovered slowly here.
And that's another good callback. You know, they find dangerous things in the mist.
Mm-hmm. It's cool how much that played into a lot of the story, obviously. I mean, so much that the Wendel relied on the fog rolling in to provide their cover for any. Obviously, I mean, the raids of my village are dependent on the weather. I mean, well, we live in Kansas, so I guess that really wouldn't actually afford us much comfort. But, you know, obviously it's pretty common there and part of their mythology. It's everything is unclear or mysterious or dark or witchy out there. So I thought that was cool, though. Stuff. And no Northmen. Let's just knock it out some of these early ones pretty easily.
Araberen! We must send the Araber.
Tartius decimus homo, septem trium no skit.
She says the 13th man must be no Northman.
What the hell are you saying?
The 13th warrior is you.
You, Omar.
Now, I will say, point of order, it could have been Omar. He was from an Arabic-speaking country.
He was no Northman.
He could actively speak to one of the people without learning a language he didn't know.
Yeah, what were they speaking? Because he said something about Greek, but I saw in trivia somewhere said they were speaking Latin.
Omar spoke Greek. Joya spoke Latin back to him.
Back to him. Okay. So.
So that there was understanding, if not actual, because he could speak Greek. He could hear Greek, but not really speak it comfortably. And when he spoke the Latin back, he understood enough of the Latin to translate back.
Greek and Latin have a lot in common.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're old languages in the same part of the world. That's not surprising. Yeah. But it's all Greek to me.
It's all Greek to even the captioners, too.
Even my wife laughed at that. She's two rooms away.
It's all Greek to the captioners, too, because Melchizedek says something, and it says, speaking Greek, and then Joyous says something back, and it says, speaking Greek, and I'm like, but that's Latin.
So, even better. So I there's this point in the movie where it kind of takes a turn. Obviously, he goes with them, and from that point forward, the focus of the movie really narrows in on his personal experience, and the experience is temporal. It's like one moment to the next, and things are changing, and things are happening, and you know that's the story. So I was catching these clips, and I was thinking about it while I was pulling these last night, and I realized that there is a lot in this movie, and I think it's one of the reasons I enjoy it so much. That feels very much like a good D&D game. Feels very much like a strong role-playing experience. The brotherhood, the way they approach the combats, the kind of the organization of skills and approaches, the fight that he has, the duel that he has, the king's showdown at the end, all this stuff, the Vikings, the prayer, all this stuff really just kind of folds into those really great moments that we have sometimes in role-playing games. It makes me feel like this movie is a good expression of that sort of feel, not that sort of story being told precisely, but you could see it. You could see somebody taking this and making an adventure out of it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's not so hard to imagine.
Oh, yeah.
It's straightforward enough. So here we go with some fun ones. I call this one, It's Dangerous to Go Alone.
Here. You'll need this. I cannot lift this. Grow stronger.
That was a fun sequence. I enjoyed that one.
A solution to a simple problem.
Here, have a schlager. You might not be able to swing it, but you have it.
You know, it's the thought that counts, right?
Yeah, but I really loved later. Give an Arab a sword and he turns it into a knife.
Oh yeah, I got that too.
That's coming.
Eaters of the Dead.
They have been... Nodable.
It is said they eat the dead.
What kind of a man could do that?
It was not man. It's a Mendo.
They are here.
I know I played that at the intro, but it's still good. I want it again.
Now, I have to say that this has another bit of element of D&D-ness to it. Antonio walks in, and there's a guy strung up by his ankles, missing his head, dripping out. And he goes, ugh. And he walks into the next room, and there's a bunch of people kneeling down around another body that is also missing its head and just coated in all sorts of ichor and grossness. And he goes, ugh. And then he walks over to a bed, and there's a hand, and he kind of taps the blanket with his sword and lifts it up just enough, and the hand falls out of the bed with an arm unaccompanied, at which point he
feels like, so safe.
I cannot handle this anymore. All of that was fine, but not an arm.
Oh, and don't forget those bodies had obvious bites.
Oh, yes, and those bodies had been indeed gnawed upon.
I think the breaking
but
point
not the
was
arm.
He had steeled himself for a dead body, and he only got the arm, and that made it that much worse, and that just kicked him over because he wasn't ready for it.
But you're right. I could see it in one of our games. You know, I could see it being entirely the player's decision.
That's a game moment right there. It's like,
It's great.
Body.
Dismembered
or like you said, they failed their save. That was the die. That was the one that turned them.
I am not a
Cthulhu,
warrior.
My horror check.
When they come, we form a circle in the center of the room, backs to one another. I am not a warrior. Very soon, you will be.
Very soon, you will be.
They're so pragmatic about these things. I absolutely love it.
Very good.
We gave you a sword. What more do you want?
And course, I love after the battle, in the aftermath, they find him and they're like, he didn't run away.
Well, I skipped
over
the pony part because I didn't have a really great
and idea. He got his one. Dog
could jump.
Not only did he run away, they're like,
he gutted one.
I can't find any of their dead. They're not, none of their corpses are here. Even the Arab gutted at least one.
Makes a knife.
An Arab sword, he makes a knife.
It works.
When you die, can I give that to my daughter?
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that the music in that scene had that ever so slight Arabian flair to it.
All of the music has that ever so slight Arabian flair to it. It's his story.
Exactly. I really appreciated the score for this movie because of that Arabian flair, since it's told from his perspective and he's the main focus. If they'd have done it any other way, it wouldn't have fit right.
Yeah, I just wish I could have bought that he was an Arab.
Foolish and expensive.
You could have killed him at will.
Yes?
Why the deception?
Deception is the point. Any fool can calculate strength. That one has been doing it for the moment he saw us. Now he has to calculate what he can't see.
Fear, well, he doesn't know.
As you say, foolish and expensive. We will miss Angus tonight. We will miss his sword.
I love the fact that Angus was like 12 feet tall.
He was a mountain. Holy God, yeah.
Dude, sucker was huge. I wonder if they had him on the lifts. I mean, it was ridiculous.
I think they just legitimately got a really big...
Yeah, I think they found him. His whole body was proportionate to that feeling.
The duel kind of made me a little irritated, though, because it was a continuation of part of a plot point that didn't go anywhere.
That's true. It's kind of like they begged him off and then that was it. Oh, look, we've done the thing.
Yeah, because they started out with the son of the place that they were in is poisoning his father to try to take the throne. And he's afraid Bolowulf will take it. I'm like, oh, cool. That sounds like a neat story. Done with that. Never mentioned again.
I bet that is exactly the kind of stuff they're talking about when they talk about plot holes or when the movie got all mixed up and jumbled. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel like there was supposed to be more there.
And yeah, it's actually kind of impressive to me that you see less of that, or that you don't see more of that than you do. If it was as chopped up as they say, it they held it together pretty well.
That was the main one that I caught when I was going through, as I got that and I was just like, this sounds like an interesting storyline, and never mentioned again. I was just like, well, so much for that excitement.
Yeah.
Well, after this sequence was the battle where things really turned.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. We enjoyed Antonio Banderas's character experiencing the leveling up a badass trope, where he goes into rage mode and just starts killing everybody. That moment when he realized, wasn't that what it was? When he realized, oh, they're men.
Yep.
Yeah, he walks around for a while muttering, it's a man.
It's a man.
It's a man. And then he just got pissed.
And he does it with that cool-ass Antonio accent.
He's a man. That cool-ass Antonio non-Arabic accent.
Yeah, that one.
It wasn't that far off.
It was good. And then there was this little sequence.
I cannot taste neither the fermentation of rape nor of wheat. What? Why do you laugh?
Honey! It's made from honey!
Yeah!
His laugh was so good there! Dug that.
It accentuated so beautifully what he was saying.
Has anybody thought about going to the Middle East and opening a meadery?
A meadery? Is that what it's called?
I don't know.
Let's not. So there's that. I don't know how.
I don't know how actually strict it is in modern day.
And I'm not sure about the denigration of character there either. It's like, so he goes from, he goes nuts in battle and just starts killing left and right. Now, you know, obviously, historically, Arabs don't necessarily have a problem with that. But he also, he then, you know, he's drinking and then he gets bedded. And then he, you know, everything about his attitude just relaxes a cinch at that point. So it is the major turning point for the character, right? If there is one,
yeah.
You know.
And I actually have a thing to say about that I was thinking. He got sent away, Because he already knew the love of a woman.
Well, there's the implication. I was reading about that, too, to see if there was anything clear that it was unrequited or unconsummated.
I don't know about that. It might have been. But it was if it was unrequited, he got banished for just having seen her.
We're talking about Arab culture. Women are, you know, all covered.
And she was all covered.
Important possessions.
But I'm just saying, I would put my money down that was not his first experience. And the other,
it isn't really specifically about that. I mean,
right. You know, and then the other thing, chain of events, is that he didn't do his prayers like he always should. He had a come to Allah moment near the end.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, like, with the exception of the fact that he refused to drink, he was not that pious. It's like it's like not drinking was that one little thing that he held on to say, I'm being good.
But he held it up in terms of his, you know, the beliefs that he espoused and you know, what he wanted to believe in about himself, obviously.
Right.
He was going through a thing that was transformative, and, you know, there was no other way to deal with it. So that stranger in the strange land thing, you know.
Yeah.
I felt that stuff worked, though. And the other thing that happened in that sequence that I really loved was when he jumped the gate with the horse. And they're all like, open the gate, open the gate. They're over to the gate. And then one guy just pulls the other guy down and says, get down, knowing that he's about to do exactly that.
He's just like, yep. The horse, like, clear it. You haven't seen this. Bonk.
That dog can jump.
Good stuff. I've only got a couple left.
I have only these hands. I will die a pauper.
You will be buried as a king.
A man might be thought wealthy if someone were to draw the story of his deeds, that they may be remembered.
Such a man might be thought wealthy, indeed.
I felt like this was the beginning of the denouement, obviously. It was very important. But this was even still before the final fight. And the coolest thing about that final fight is it still had this feeling of being so unexpected. It's like, we're just kind of hanging around. We're dealing with the aftermath. We're weary. We're like, oh my God, what happens now? Ah, there they are, you know.
They came before nightfall.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They will have their vengeance tonight. Oh shit, it'll be right now.
Oh, we didn't talk about the fire dragon thing either.
Oh yeah, the fireworm.
That's pretty cool.
The glow.
So
I saw the glowworm, though. Saw it good, I did.
But all this was after, I was going to talk about the bear hunting thing, because it was about the finding the cave. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, how do you hunt bears? I found it interesting, the going to the seer and getting some, feedback from her. And then taking that message forward in hunting them down, and then finding the cave, and then, of course, the underwater sequence, which was a little harrowing to watch. Not bad.
Yeah.
But a little harrowing. I actually did pretty good ones, because the tight space water thing kind of gets to me, but when they showed it, it seemed like they had plenty of room to kind of move around while they were swimming. So I was like, okay, this isn't bad. Nobody's drowning yet.
Still look too tight for me, but that's a me thing.
Didn't somebody actually drown?
Almost.
No, they're making it.
One of the actors portraying one of the 13 almost drowned on set during that scene. Antonio dived in and saved him.
Nice. Real hero moment. I like that.
He's such a great guy. I actually struggle with that, and the same thing in any movie that shows underwater scenes, because unconsciously, whenever someone goes underwater, I start trying to hold my breath. And if I can't hold my breath as long as they're underwater, it starts to make me very uncomfortable for them.
Exactly. I start experiencing actual anxiety because it's impossible.
And right. This was well past where I could hold my breath.
So I'm the only one okay with underwater scenes.
Yes, you're the only one okay with underwater scenes.
Good for you.
I have.
Which is why The Abyss is our lowest rated movie.
Oh, yeah. I struggled with that in The Abyss, too.
I have one more clip. You guys have anything else to say before I go?
Nope.
Oh, actually, yes. Sorry.
Go for it.
I almost forgot, but this was actually a really awesome point that they made, because recording the deeds of the dead so that they would be remembered became such a huge thing in their culture that 90% of what we have historically of their writings is the writings of poets and scalds about the deeds of the heroes and kings of their people. That's almost everything they left us, is all these stories about their deeds. And we've had to put together what we know by picking through that. So it's kind of funny to me because this is actually historically about the point in time when that started.
10th century.
Yes. It's again, that dedication to historical accuracy that is portrayed here is just incredible to me.
I seem to remember last 10 years or so, you would occasionally see articles come up if you follow those kinds of things where it would say, you know, new archaeological find. We've learned something new about Norse culture. You know, it seems to happen a lot. Like, this is like one of the most obscure real cultures in the world or something. Maybe because it's one of the few strong cultures of its era that doesn't really have strong representation to today. So there's no through line of that tradition.
It's because they didn't have written records
right.
until the influence of Christianity.
Yeah.
And when the Christians started teaching them how to write, they also started changing things.
Right. As they're wont to do. That's kind of part of their heritage there, historically speaking. Let's make everybody more like we want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that's interesting. I seem to remember reading that we've learned that women had a much different role in their culture than we thought they did.
That's
much more
correct.
Important role.
Yes, that is accurate.
And a lot of our depictions and our ideas of the kind of the raping, pillaging Viking are somewhat unrealistic.
There is a relatively thin period of time when that was actually accurate. The vast majority of the time of their culture was dominant, though, they were traders. And they were such prolific traders that they established the greatest trading empire of any culture in history. They literally had trade from North America, as we now know, all the way to Russia, all the way to India, down into Africa. They traded on every continent in the world except South America, which no one had any contact with until much later.
Nobody knew was there.
Right. And they were the only ones who did. So they were mostly traders, but for a period of about 80 to 100 years, especially in the area around the English seas, they were also highly feared raiders and pillagers and slavers. And that, of course, is what is remembered.
Well, I like the depiction here.
And that's also one of the few instances of history being written by the loser.
Yes, that's a very
good point.
Because since the Vikings didn't write a lot of their own tales, the Vikings would come in and do their thing, and then the loser would go, oh, they were horrible people. They were monsters.
Right.
They were 12
paint them as
foot
monsters.
Tall. And, you know.
Some of which is true. Yeah, they were 12 feet tall.
Some
you
of
know,
it is true.
There was 100 of you know, blah 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 blah.
Right.
And also, they did another little thing that we hadn't talking about their branching out and whatnot is their armor.
Mm-hmm.
Their armor was a status symbol.
It looked very piecemeal
but,
in the movie.
Yeah, it is because they don't make their armor; they take their armor.
Oh, okay,
yep.
That makes sense.
So,
or
like,
trade
the,
for it.
Or trade for it. But and the better armor you have, the cooler you are, which is another little nod to them growing respect for Eben because they give him that cool black chainmail suit.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Love that. So, again, more attention to cultural historical detail and whatnot. All right. The Halls of Valhalla. This one's a little longer. I wouldn't have wanted to play the whole thing.
Thank you.
Lo, there do I see my father. Lo, there do I see my mother and my sisters and my brothers. Lo, there do I see the line of
my people back to the beginning.
Lo, they do call to me. They bid me take my place among them.
In the halls of Valhalla,
they
live
forever.
So good. It gives me chills listening to it.
Every time. 21 years
so
later,
good.
Every time. And one little single tear always forms.
Oh, wow. All right. I guess we're ready for this. That seems kind of anticlimactic after all the music and stuff. And stuff.
Yeah, after that right. rousing, you know,
I'm really sorry, guys. I should come up with something more dramatic for this show.
Way to kill the mood.
All right, thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you got, Rich?
On my thumbs down, as much as I generally dislike dark and obscure enemies, The Warriors from the Mist, I would have liked to have had a more mysterious feel. Even though their first early interactions were quick and not focused in detail, I felt too much was known too soon. Then again, I had read the book, so it's not like I didn't fully know. But I could have used a little bit more, we don't know what we're really facing at a higher level. On thumbs up, though, the effort that went into it, just a number of details in this movie, especially the language, it annoyed me at first. But when I saw what they were doing, in the moment it all came together, I greatly appreciated the journey. It's a good movie. If you like old world battles, the genre, or just that it's fairly well adapted from actual texts, contestable, whatever, you should definitely see the movie. Banderas brings the character's Stranger in a Strange Land trope to life with so much wonder and spirit. I will not wait over a decade to watch it again. 4 stars.
Nice. What do you got for us, Vanessa?
Thumbs up. Compelling story. Loved it. Well-developed characters. Beautifully developed scenery and score. I loved the way that everything was done. This is one of the first movies that I've seen Antonio Banderas in that he actually seemed like he was acting. that may sound weird, but I
get that. I get that.
His star was on the rise when you were really young.
Yeah, so and that might be part of the thing.
I don't know what movies you've seen, obviously, but I get it.
Not a lot. You know this. Thumbs down.
I got a sounder for that somewhere.
I'm sure you do.
Okay.
Thumbs down. There were a few dropped plot points. The main one being the son that was poisoning the father, or at least the main one I remember. I know there were more. I just didn't write them down. I wanted to feel like the story was more developed on the back end. Like, you got the main story, and there were a few subplots, but there could have been more built around it. Overall rating, still a 4.5. It wasn't perfect, but I really enjoyed it, and I'm certainly going to watch it again. And nice. I would recommend it to everyone.
Nice. Well done. Jason?
Okay. So, thumbs up. I really do love this film. I've loved it for many, many years. I saw it when it came out, and I've seen it many times since. It's one of those that if I'm flipping channels and it's on, the remote puts down. It's a stopper for me. Kind of like Clue. If I see it, I watch it.
Oh no. Yeah.
That's all there is to it. And I will say that I love the character development. I love the mystery of the people. I thought there was just enough bad guy mystery. In fact, I wouldn't have argued knowing a little bit more about them. We don't know their tribe name. We don't know anything about them other than the rumors that they were the Eaters of the Dead. But I love the going into the cave and getting into the things and just all of the characters' growth, their arcs, especially Eben. Eben has this amazing arc from philandering, sit on your butt, happy boy, to the 13th warrior. He had a great transition and they showed it very well, and I really enjoyed that. Thumbs down, a lot of it I hadn't ever noticed before this viewing. I didn't have thumbs down until yesterday.
Aww.
But now I do. And it's okay. That's okay. It is okay to be able to see flaws.
No film is perfect anyway.
No film is perfect. Yeah. You know, there are some that are pretty damn close.
Yeah.
But there were some, and most of them were more editing and technical bits, which hearing some of this story about having multiple directors, like, they're in this party and they say, call for the Bone Woman, and she's there. It's like they turn around and she's walking through the door. It's like, okay, you don't have
they
to call
her. They keep her hanging
her
on the coat rack in the next room.
Right,
yeah.
There. You know, so that felt weird. And I understand that they just didn't want to take an extra 3 minutes to go get her, but damn.
Oh, actually, I would just interject real quick. That was part of the mystique, is that she knew she was about to be summoned, so she was already there.
And then another one was the cool scene where the horse, the dog can jump.
Mm-hmm.
It's all muddy, but it's a nice blue sunny sky. Everything's great. And they show him and he goes and he rides out into the distance and then he jumps over this thing and then jumps over that thing. And then he starts riding straight towards the camera and it is boring. It is pouring down rain for the 2 seconds he's riding straight towards the camera. And then the camera goes to a back shot again, and it's again a sunny sky.
I didn't notice that at all. That's crazy.
So little things like that, I too am going to give it a 4.5.
Oh, well, I feel you. I really liked the that sequence with the horse. And I didn't know at the time that I saw this movie the first time, I didn't know much about horses. And Jonica is from a horse family, and a kid worked on a horse ranch. That's how I met him. I'm not going to make a joke about that. He was on a horse ranch. He worked on a horse ranch for a while, which I know was one of the more challenging and fascinating jobs in his life. But which I guess calling it a ranch is actually kind of a disservice, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's technically accurate. He had 50 head of cattle there, too. So
Okay. But it is a horse trainer, one of the more renowned horse trainers in the country. I learned a lot later, in later viewings or after later viewings, and I didn't know what an Arabian was, as far as the horses go. It's having watched this now and thinking back to those discussions with my wife, and okay, now I get it. Yeah, I get it. And of course, their horses are those massive draft horses and stuff.
Yeah,
like by contrast, so it was a great sequence. I loved it.
Yeah, I love that too.
Kid, what do you got?
All right, and I've obviously kind of given a lot of this away already, but my thumbs up, very simply, is the just immersive detail into the Norse culture that they give us in this movie, and how accurate and how just incredibly thorough and pervasive it is. You are immersed in this culture for most of this movie. And as, like I said, an avid fan of the culture, I am absolutely enthralled. I love it. This is one of the best portrayals that existed in a video format until we got the Vikings, which was obviously top notch because that was the whole point of it. It was done by the History Channel.
Yeah,
that was there.
So was the whole kick.
But we're not going to go with that.
but he's making a point, and it is a recognizable point.
The point stands.
So that is absolutely with a bullet my major thumbs up for this movie, and I struggled to give it anything for a thumbs down. I really did. And I have to say, this is pretty much the only context I can really find myself in that I would expect to be criticizing Antonio Banderas, whom I absolutely love as an actor, and I love watching him on the screen. I couldn't buy him as an Arab, and that, it's a tiny nitpick, but it is the only thing in this movie I could really find that I felt I could criticize. The accent, he did an incredible job. But I just got pulled ever so slightly out of it because he wasn't Arabic. And that's all I can really criticize. I have to give this movie 5 stars.
Nice. All right. I'm actually going to fall in the 4.5 camp, Rich. I think it's pretty obvious where this one's going to land on our composite. But yeah, I felt like the movie, it had all the promise that I wanted in a rewatch. And it reminded me of all the things that I loved about it. But there are points in the movie that I felt like it loses me just a little bit here and there, and I have to make myself get back into it. And that, that's just not a big deal, but it was the only thing that kind of snuck up on me. Mostly, I enjoyed the hell out of it. So
yes.
There you go. All right. So that's a look at the 13th Warrior. Do you want to say it officially, Rich?
No, yeah, I said 4.5. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
I was gabbing.
I was looking at numbers.
4.5, really?
Yeah. I think it was like 4.5.
I was the low scorer. I was the dissenter.
For some reason, I thought it was going to lean towards the 7.5. I guess it wouldn't. It wouldn't. That because half.
It's 4.5 or 4.5.
Yeah, never mind.
And the rest.
Does that make it our highest rating now?
Yes and no.
Other than like Big Fish.
I have tweaked the algorithm. So our totals now go to quarters, which they did not do before.
Which I like. Yeah.
So officially to announce that, the biggest thing is that while this is 4.5 and we have other 4.5, like Big Fish was a 4.5. Odd Thomas was 4.75 under the new calc.
Oh.
So Odd Thomas is the only one above it.
And where was Big Fish? Because that was the other one that we had.
Well, Big Fish was 4.5 as 4. Well. And then the rest are 4.25.
Cool. I like that. All right.
So I'm liking the new numbers already.
Definitely.
This week, huh?
Yeah, I like that too.
So what do we got for next week, Vanessa?
We have War Games.
Oh, yes. Ooh. 1984, Matthew Broderick. I'm thinking this is going to be a fun one to watch. Have you ever seen it,
Nope.
Vanessa?
Sure haven't.
Nope. Shall we play a game?
So this may or may not be interesting to you. This will be an interesting experience. All right, so make sure and watch that before next week and join us live on Saturdays at 2 p.m. if you want to join us on Twitch TV, twitch.tv/prismatictsunami. For Rich, for Vanessa, for Jason and the kid, I'm Eric. Everybody have a fantastic week, and we'll see you next time.